I hope the volume is okay. If you have to adjust it, feel free. This evening I'm going to give a talk on a book called The Myth of Freedom and the Way of Meditation by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who is a teacher of Tibetan Buddhist practice. And this is a book that I read many years ago. And then I read it again. I've really appreciated it. And I had another look at it today and wanted to share with you a few passages, actually quite a few. And I'm going to string them together in a kind of summative talk and then comment on it a bit. I will flow in and out of his text, just so you know. Some of the time it'll be his words, some of the time mine, but you can know where the words are coming from, this joint creation here. I want to start with a passage. One of the things I love about this book is how shocking it is. For example, to have a title called The Myth of Freedom as a Buddhist text, when, of course, what do we say but liberate, free all beings, our bodhisattva vow. So intended to put us on the path in a way that is sincere and that cuts through spiritual materialism. We have ideas of freedom, and then there is freedom itself, and our ideas are not it. And we get lost in our ideas all the time. So a big portion of this book is dedicated to helping us cut through those ideas of freedom that we might have to help us attain true liberation, which is not an idea. So it begins with a series of quotes here that I'll read with you, and as I said, interspersed with some explanation discussion. Awareness of bodily movement, breath, and one's physical situation are techniques common to all traditions. The basic practice is to be present, right here. The goal is also the technique. This is our practice, right? We sit with the breath. We sit with the sensation of the body, the sensation of the heart, perhaps watching thoughts as they are interpenetrated by all of these sensations. And actually, it is a very simple practice that could be the beginning and the end of this whole talk. But the mind, of course, often thinks that we deserve more. And this is part of what Trungpa is trying to respond to, is the way the mind creates expectations for ourselves out of practice. Expectations that we be different from how we actually are. Expectations that our experience not be quite what it actually is. And these expectations come from somewhere, and he really dives into where those expectations often come from. The Buddha taught that our suffering is often bound up, or is fundamentally caused by a belief in a separate, fixed self that persists over time. And this book begins to connect some of the dots, help us understand why might that cause us suffering, this belief in a fixed, separate self. So the simplicity of narrowness of practice, of just being with the breath, of just being present to things as they are, brings an open attitude toward life situations, because we realize that there is no escape of any kind and give in to being right on the spot. There's the heart of our practice. Just attending to what is, moment after moment, nothing more to it. Of course, this is a path of disappointment in many regards, because we expect our lives to be different because of practice. We don't expect we're just going to turn toward things as they are. We say, I expect enlightenment. As long as we follow a spiritual approach, promising salvation, miracles, liberation, then we are bound by the golden chain of spirituality. In other words, we're seeking something other than what we are. And our liberation is in what we actually are, not in something other than what we are. So we get lost in these wild goose chases, chasing after what we think wisdom should look like, not seeing the wisdom that is emerging in our actual existence. The effort to secure our happiness, to maintain ourselves in relation to something else, and that something else might be our notion of enlightenment, is the process of ego. But this effort is futile because there are continual gaps in our seemingly solid world, continual cycles of death and rebirth, constant change. The sense of continuity and solidity of self is an illusion. There is really no such thing as ego, soul, or Atman. It is a succession of confusions that create ego. The process which is ego, I love how he calls it process, the process which is ego actually consists of a flicker of confusion, a flicker of aggression, a flicker of grasping, all of which exist only in the moment. Since we cannot hold on to the present moment, we cannot hold on to me and mine and make them solid things. And yet, we are scared when we confront this openness, this lack of solidity. As we first confront that, we can become afraid. And thus comes the desire for some sort of state that we can hold on to. He goes at length into how it is that this leads to the creation, this clinging, this desire to solidify our sense of self, which is actually ever-changing, ends up creating a sense of self that is I, sense of self, which is the form first. It's the body, right? Physical form. And then it manifests in other ways too. It manifests essentially as a fear of aloneness, which makes us create a sense of there being other beings too who have solidity as well. There's me, and then there's other beings. And then we develop some feeling about those other beings. And then we develop perceptions of them, quite complex, riddled with feeling. And ultimately, you can hear the Heart Sutra in all of this. Ultimately, mental reactions, which are our concepts of others, reified, which we return to again and again. And finally, consciousness, which is like a story that strings it all together. So this is how we create a world that we live in, that we imagine has some kind of permanence, because we're so frightened in some ways of the spaciousness, of the lack of permanence that is the actuality of what we turn toward when we turn toward life. The whole development of the five skandhas, form, feeling, perception, concepts, and consciousness, is an attempt on our part to shield ourselves from the truth of our insubstantiality. So, a big consequence of this practice that we get into, this habit that we get into, is that we begin to create realms for ourselves based on the stories that we tell about ourselves and the world and what we like and we don't like. We begin to create what they call the six realms. And you've perhaps heard of these before, but the six realms, I'll go through them each very quickly. The six realms, basically there's the heavenly realm. And this he describes as practices that we entertain for long periods of time with great hopes of bringing about peace. And sometimes they temporarily do. The heavenly realm is this temporary place that we enter when some sort of practice that we've become attached to works, what we think of as works. We may feel joyous, we may feel bliss. We may find fearlessness, fearfulness falls away. And we think, now I've made it. Notice how the I enters so quickly into this place. I'm a good practitioner. Look, I'm at peace. Look how happy I am. So the ego simply forms around these states and thinks of these states as permanent. And of course, the fundamental teaching of Buddhism is that there's nothing that's permanent. So these practices inevitably fail us, and then the suffering is, the landing is twice as intense. Undoubtedly, many of us have been on retreat before where we've been practicing some technique, and you maybe have been on Sesshin, a very intense retreat, and you're practicing this technique and feeling really good and really good about yourself, and then inevitably, it falls apart. Your amazing breath work, your mantra, your idea about this world that you thought was the key to saving yourself from suffering just fails. And when we land in those circumstances, boy, do we hurt all the more. And the ego suffers too because we thought we'd made it. So that's one realm that we often enter into when we think that practice is to bring about a particular mind state and we hold on to it, the heavenly realm. It's not bad in and of itself, but ultimately leads to a kind of deeper suffering. The second realm is the realm of the jealous gods. This is one where we compare ourselves to others. So again, this is all the what he calls the bureaucracy of ego at work. We compare ourselves to others in this realm. Now, all of us are kind of prone to one of these realms, maybe a couple of them. It's not really a judgment to say that these realms happen. It's just to say this is part of what happens with mental formations. And when the self is selfing, we enter into particular realms. So the jealous gods are comparing themselves all the time. The mentality is preoccupied with comparison because we believe in self and other. Passion, this is the third realm, we might say, is the human realm. And the human realm is all about essentially fighting for and attaining what we want. It's a pushing for our particular desires. Thinking that there are things that we can attain that are outside of ourselves that will secure our position and our happiness in the world. The next realm, it's so funny, he calls it the stupidity realm. It's actually the animal realm. And it can be quite clever in the way that we get caught in this realm. A person can be brilliant and be caught in the animal realm. There's a kind of cleverness to it sometimes. But really what it is it's the extreme animal mentality is trapped in a continual self-contained, self-justifying round of activity. You are not able to relate with the messages given to you by your environment because you're closed off in a single-minded quest for what it is that you want. Of course, notice again, there is an idea that I can get something, I can possess it, and when I do, I will be happy. The next realm is the hungry ghost realm. The hungry ghost realm is one preoccupied with the process of expanding, becoming rich, and consuming. It's a little bit different from desire. The desire realm can be caught up with attainment. I'm going to achieve certain things. Hungry ghost realm is connected with consuming. Constantly hungering for new entertainment, spiritual, intellectual, sensual, and so on. Intellectually, you may feel inadequate and decide to pull up your socks by studying and listening to juicy, thoughtful answers, profound mystical words. So this can be a kind of spiritual hunger too. And the last realm is the hell realm. The hell realm is pervaded by anger. Again, I don't think of them as being one being heaven and hell ranking, right? We suffer from all of these realms, and it's not that one is better or worse than any other. We imagine, I'd like to be in the heavenly realm, but people suffer from falling out of the heavenly realm. often fall into the hell realm where we become very angry. So that gives a description of, and basically in the hell realm, what we're trying to do is destroy the things that cause us suffering. Again, imagining that they have substance, and once I destroy this thing, I will be happy. Can be getting rid of it, getting it out of our lives. We've all felt this, probably with past politicians. So we have a practice for encountering ourselves. These are the many manifestations of the self, we might say. And I think that there's a temptation when we read this kind of a book that, oh, okay, then my practice is going to be to get rid of this self. As soon as I get rid of it, then I'll have liberation. But notice how that just cycles right back into a notion of attaining something different. I'm going to attain something different, and through that practice, I'll be happy, right? So we can easily hear this Dharma and then think, well, okay, good. I'll just get rid of the self then, and I'll be all set. But really, our practice is not to try to get rid of a self, because to do so is to believe in a self to be gotten rid of. Our practice instead is to simply bear witness. Bear witness to whatever is arising. We must be willing to be completely ordinary people. We must be willing to be completely ordinary people. Which means accepting ourselves as we are without trying to become greater, purer, more spiritual, more insightful. If we can accept our imperfections as they are, quite ordinarily, then we can use them as part of the path. In fact, we don't even use them. They just are the path. In fact, we need our delusions. We need our moments of our lack of clarity. Samsara and nirvana are not divided from each other. Emptiness and form are not separate. How can we experience the emptiness of the self if there is no self? The self, selfing, is emptiness. Our practice is to see the ego emerge, is to hear the bird songs coming and going, dancing through this openness of awareness, which is simply what we are. We are this ever-changing stage. He goes on to say, in mindfulness practice, there is no goal, no journey. You are just mindful of what is happening. There is no promise of love or light or visions of any kind, no angels, no devils. Nothing happens. It is absolutely boring. Sometimes you feel silly. One often asks the question, who is kidding whom? Am I on to something or not? You are not on to something. Traveling the path means you get off everything. There is no place to perch. Sit and feel your breath. Be with it. Boredom is important because it helps remove this idea of some sort of special attainment, of feeding the ego, of the credentials that we seek in just about every other part of our life. I'm special. I've attained this. I've done that. I've accrued this, that, and the other thing. When we're bored in our practice, that might be a good sign. It might be a sign that you've given up seeking special states. So that is why we work with simple things like the breath in our practice. Simply relating with the breath is very monotonous and unadventurous. We do not discover the third eye is opening. I love this part of his book. It's so funny. His tone is wonderful. It's like hilarious and also very discouraging for people who are new to practice. We do not discover that the third eye is opening or that chakras are unfolding. It is like a stone-carved Buddha sitting in the desert. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens. And we realize that nothing is happening. Strangely, we begin to realize that something dignified is happening. There is no room for frivolity. There's something very satisfying and wholesome in this boredom. This is a very simple-minded approach to sanity. And we begin in this practice to sense into, not theorize about, but sense into the true nature of our life. We no longer philosophize about the taste of our food. To appreciate your life is not the same thing as to tell a story about it. When someone says appreciate your food as you're sitting there eating, it doesn't mean that you speak to your food and tell it how much you love it and tell it that it has a fine salty taste and it has this, that, and the other thing. It means you taste it. Taste your life, moment after moment. And in that tasting, we begin to notice the openness that's there, that's penetrating everything. We notice thoughts coming and going and the transparency of these thoughts, that they aren't rigid, fixed beings. We notice that the ego itself has no center. How do we notice this? This is an actual noticing, a tasting of the ego. Because as we taste the thoughts that arise that contribute to a sense of self, as we taste the feelings themselves, we don't turn away from them, we don't avoid them. We actually taste them in our mouth. And we notice that they're like water. They just come and go and vanish. Entire senses of self coming into being and vanishing from existence. This is what's meant by emptiness. And there's real liberation in that. We're no longer a prisoner to these senses of self. There is tremendous space in which the universality of inspiration is happening. There is pain, but there is also the environment around the origin of pain. The whole thing becomes more expansive, more open. In sitting with things as they are, we see the non-essence of things as they are in our freedom in letting everything be. There's no separate self who will be overwhelmed by feelings, just fluid, non-dualistic energy flowing through us, neither good nor bad. You know, as we begin to taste this openness, this boundlessness, as we call it, in Boundless Ways End. This, Trungpa calls it centerless awareness. Thoughts are just a part of it. They're not the center of us anymore. We practice with these thoughts, opening with them. And mind states come and occlude our openness, and we get caught up in these mind states. And rather than running away from them or trying to control them, we turn toward them and look into them and begin to see their true nature. This is the invitation. We see that all these senses of self have no separate fixed essence, and it opens us to all beings. This openness to all beings really is the essence of our Bodhisattva vow. It is the beginning of our living according to the Eightfold Path. This non-separation, this openness. The Eightfold Path is born out of our true nature. We don't come to see our true nature by getting rid of anything. It's by letting everything be just as it is and practicing in a very simple way, not expecting anything different, not expecting the ego to vanish, but instead expecting to understand its true nature, not expecting the content of our experience to change. That's the key to practice. Because in that we begin, there's an invitation in that to meet ourselves compassionately just as we are, to see ourselves truly. All Dharma flows from that. Thank you.